You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
How much plastic is embedded into your body tissue right now? Well, Professor John Wargo of Yale says much more than you might think. His new book, Green Intelligence, Creating Environments That Protect Human Health, is intended as a wake-up call about the extent to which man-made chemicals are being pumped into the air we breathe, the food we eat, and the water we drink. And he says the companies that produce the chemicals don't want you to know anything about them, even if they might be harmful to your health or the health of your children. The book is published by Yale University Press and is based on Mr. Wargo's years of research at the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show today. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
There are so many aspects of the so-called green revolution, from recycling to refocusing on energy efficiency to local farming. Do you feel too little attention is being paid to man-made chemicals?
Oh, I do. I think especially with public concern and corporate concern about climate change issues, the area of chemical exposure and human health risks has been pushed aside. I think it's a problem that is equal in importance, and I also think that it is wildly out of control.
So what happens when you try to interest the public in this story? Is it difficult for people to grasp?
No, I don't think it is. I think it's intuitive for most people. The exposures that I talk about in the book include radionuclides, pesticides, plasticizers, vehicle exhaust, especially diesel particulate matter. And, you know, most people understand that these elements are out in the environment, and they just don't know where they are.
Now, those five man-made chemicals are extremely diverse. So what do they have in common?
Well, what they have in common, curiously, is the difficulty that humans have in sensing them in their environments. So we can't see these chemicals, we can't taste them, smell them, feel them, unless they're parts of other larger molecules.
Do the organizations involved, which include the U.S. military, automobile companies, the manufacturers of pesticides and the like, do anything to alert the public to the potentially harmful effects that chemical exposure has on our health?
In general, no, unless they're required to by law. For example, pesticides have to be labeled under federal law. But the ingredients of plastic materials in water bottles or in the epoxy lining of a soup can, for example, that does not need to be labeled.
And why is that?
Well, I think that a major failure of environmental law to this time has been the neglect of the chemical industry. There are some exceptions to that, pharmaceuticals and pesticides, but there are nearly 80,000 chemicals in international commerce, and these have escaped attention.
You call a number of organizations the antagonists of, in your book, and that includes a number of government agencies like the Atomic Energy Commission, the Department of Energy, the Department of Defense. How are they antagonistic? Aren't they working for us?
Well, I think that they have perceived that they have a primary central mission of national security. And the addition of the value of environmental quality and human health has come late to them. And throughout the nation, there are contaminated bases where they trained, where troops resided, not just in the U.S., but around the world. And some of the most badly contaminated sites in the world are under U.S. Defense Department jurisdiction.
And the Clean Air Act doesn't apply?
Well, the Clean Air Act should apply, and they have made arguments about why it should not. The Clean Water Act should apply, but much of the damage, much of the chemical release on those sites, and by the way, the last this was tallied, there are about 50,000 sites under the jurisdiction of the Department of Energy, the Department of the Interior, and the Department of Defense that are classified as seriously contaminated. And it will take probably take several lifetimes for that to be remediated, if it is at all.
There are plastic vehicle manufacturers and the like who are claiming to be green. Would they agree with you?
Well, I think they would have to agree with me that they are very lightly regulated. compared to these other sectors of the economy that I described. But I think that they would debate the problem with these residues coursing through the veins of every American. So there's an increasing intensity and debate about bisphenol A, which is a component of polycarbonate plastics. That would be hard plastic, water bottles that backpackers would use, for example, would contain this large 5-gallon jugs of drinking water that bottled water companies would deliver would contain this. They're under no obligation to disclose what the ingredients are, and the testing is coming late, and that's a core issue.
Now, why aren't they under obligation? We have laws to protect ourselves. Do they get special dispensation, or is this a matter of protecting patent rights?
Well, the patent issue is really important, so that they are not anxious to disclose the exact ingredients or the proportions that they have in their various products. They believe that would confer competitive advantage to others. So, in the book, I really focused on this issue, the dangers of trade secrecy, the dangers of classified information, and how that prevents the public from understanding the nature of risk that they face in everyday environments.
But they are also facing lawsuits, aren't they? Does it have to hit? You're shaking your head, and not all that important.
Well, I think.
I mean, is it hard to make a case against them?
Well, I think that the lawsuits would demand a high degree of evidence that chemical X produces a specific health effect that was experienced by an individual. And that proof is often extremely difficult and expensive to develop.
Now, you're not the only person who's making these claims. Why haven't there been more tests?
Well, again, the universe of chemicals out there in commerce is about 80,000, and fewer than 7% have even had the basic toxicity tests conducted on them, let alone tests for their environmental fate. In other words, what happens to them when they're released to the environment, where it goes, and how it gets into to people's bodies. I was motivated to write this book predominantly because I have three kids. And reading the Center for Disease Control reports on the number of synthetic chemicals in the human tissue of many Americans, I found to be disturbing, and I really wanted to know why that occurred. And I think that the chemical companies have gotten off very easily. EPA will claim that they are doing an effective job, but I strongly contest that. I believe that, for example, we do have national pesticide management policy, and we do have national pharmaceutical policy. But those areas pale in size compared to the rest of the synthetic chemical industry. For example, today, the plastics industry constitutes about 70% of the synthetic chemical industry. That's an enormous size. And we have no national plastics policy by comparison. There's no national plastics law.
My guest is John Wargo, professor of environmental policy, risk analysis, and political science at the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies and the Department of Political Science at Yale University. He's chair of the environmental studies major in Yale College and has been an advisor to several EPA administrators and National Academy of Sciences committees, the U.S. Congress, the U.N. World Health Organization, and former Vice President Al Gore. The author of a number of books as well. The one that we're talking about is Green Intelligence, Creating Environments That Protect Human Health. So let's talk a bit more about plastics. You say they've changed the face of the Earth and its inhabitants since 1950. How much plastic does the average American purchase in a typical year?
Typically several hundred pounds, and we do it incrementally. This is interesting. I challenge my class of several hundred students every year to spend at least a week of our term without buying any plastic. Can you do that? And they come back at the end of the week and tell me, no, they couldn't do it. Plastic packaging, plastic liners for different food products, water bottles, thinking about toothpaste tubes, brushes. So it's extremely difficult to do.
But I've always thought of plastic as inert, And you say that a lot of it winds up in our body and in our tissues.
Well, there are many hazardous chemicals inside plastics. Polyvinyl chloride is a good example. And the scale of this industry is important to think about. You know, 100 billion pounds of plastics produced every year. That's an enormous amount. And only 5% of the plastics produced each year manage to be recycled. So what happens to the rest of it? Well, it goes into either landfills, buried in the ground, and you can find plastic components in the soils and also in the groundwater beneath landfills across the nation. And also, if the plastics are burned, the chemicals are released to the atmosphere, and they can be extremely dangerous, including dioxins that are recognized to be carcinogens. So the failure to demand testing, to require ingredient disclosure, the absence of a federal plastics law, these are all underlying reasons that explain the situation.
Babies start a relationship with plastic almost from the start, don't they? Their teething rings are plastic. Their bottles, the nibbles of their bottles.
Well, that is decreasingly the case, which is good news. But many baby toys are plastic. 80% of the world's toys now are manufactured in China, and a very large percentage of those are plastics. So if you think about a baby's nursery, I mean, many families will follow their nesting instinct and put down a new carpet that's likely to be plastic. They'll buy a rail for their crib that is likely to be plastic. The paints on the walls likely have some plasticizers in it.
And what does that do to their bodies?
Well,
these
chemicals don't necessarily stay fixed. And a good example of that would be a compound known as a phthalate. It has an acronym. By the way, this chemical world is a world of acronyms, and it's difficult to do, but you need to pay attention to it. And this is called DEHP, and it makes plastic flexible. And what's curious about it is that when DEHP is added to other ingredients, it doesn't bind chemically to those ingredients, which means that it can rub off. It could be brought off in cooking. It could be brought off by microwaving it, so that basically it's quite mobile. And this explains why it gets into the environment and can get into our bodies.
And a couple of months back, we talked to somebody who had gone out to investigate the Great Pacific Garbage Patch with all of the plastics that float around there. It sounds terrible, but in the end, does that really do much damage to the environment?
Well, I think that it does, and what happens is that many plastics take hundreds or thousands of years to degrade, and that's interesting.
And fish must eat some of them. Then when we eat the fish, does that wind up in our body as well?
Well, it can. It can. The sun is one mechanism by which plastics will degrade. So light plastics will float on the surface, and they will degrade into smaller and smaller pieces and be mistaken for plankton and consumed by fish. So that the compounds can move up the marine food chain and thereby into our bodies.
My guest is Professor John Wargo of Yale. His book, Green Intelligence, Creating Environments That Protect Human Health, published by Yale University Press. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with John Wargo, who is a professor of environmental studies at Yale University and author of Our Children's Toxic Legacy, How Science and Law Fail to Protect Us from Pesticides. His most recent book is Green Intelligence, Creating Environments That Protect Human Health. It's published by Yale University Press. I've always wondered whether I'm doing something to harm my health when I walk behind an idling car. Something related to breathing in those exhaust fumes. Should I be holding my breath?
Well, I think that many people are under the misconception that vehicle exhaust is well regulated by the federal government and that it really does not constitute a threat to human health. But, you know, I take the position that they're wrong. I think that the gases that come out, they're called volatile organic compounds. The particulate matter that comes from diesel engines, these can be inhaled and they can damage human tissue. And, you know, the expectation was that we could somehow use law to force improvements in engine design and reduce emissions. And that has occurred, but the number of vehicles has increased so dramatically, and people are keeping their vehicles longer, so that we now in the nation have 235 million vehicles, and that is a number that is enough for every eligible driver in the country.
Are people who live near highways or high traffic areas more likely to be affected? What about people who drive a lot? Does it actually wind up coming back into the car?
It does. It does. And, you know, the levels within vehicles, levels of the gases and particulate matter inside a vehicle is something that we studied at Yale and with a group, Environment and Human Health, a nonprofit. And we found that the magnitude of these contaminants in the vehicle was serious. We used a school bus to do the testing. And, you know, just as one example, these particles can get deeply embedded in your lung. And diesel particulate matter has been found not just in the lung, but crossing into the bloodstream and even crossing the blood-brain barrier.
Is this worse for people who live in the city?
It would be. It would be, because cities have higher particulate counts on average than those in more rural areas.
Are hybrid cars better than regular cars?
They definitely are. They definitely are.
So they make a real significant difference in pollution?
They do. They do. And again, it would depend upon the fuel and the latest model of a hybrid, because it burns less fuel, is going to emit less per mile. So that paying attention to the mileage estimates of vehicles is one way to reduce exposure.
Again, I think about the Clean Air Act. Doesn't that apply?
Well, the Clean Air Act is it's interesting. Many people think that that's a reasonable solution. And it was very effective in reducing emissions from these large smokestacks that were very easily identifiable. And it did mandate changes in engine design. But it wasn't effective in controlling the way we use vehicles. We're driving more than we ever have before. And we have more vehicles. Also, we've moved from the suburbs and the countryside to urban regions. And this concentration of vehicles is a particular problem. I sat on the freeway between Los Angeles and San Diego about 6 months ago in an area where there were seven lanes of traffic going in each direction, and both were stopped dead for an hour. Everybody was sitting side by side, idling their engines and breathing each other's exhaust. I mean, you need to think that the exhaust pipe is usually within 10 feet of where you sit. And if you're stopped in back of a bus, the exhaust pipe of a bus may be 4 or 5 feet from the front of your own car and where you sit. So there's no filtration means that would protect you, that would keep you from being overexposed. By the way, this is a major theme of the book, that we are overexposed and we're underprotected.
Well, let's talk about some other things. A listener writes in, "Our media and public spend quite a bit of time talking about preventing and treating all sorts of cancer. Is it me, or are they totally missing the 500-pound elephant? Our environment and everything we put in it causes the cancer."
Well, I think most experts on carcinogenesis, the etiology of cancer, would argue that there is a genetic component to many cancers and there's an environmental component. And I think the history of understanding radiation and asbestos that it induces mesothelioma, a lung cancer.
Is asbestos still a problem?
Asbestos is a problem because it's a component of many older buildings. So restoration efforts need to be thought out with great care. And, for example, many older tiles are made of polyvinyl chloride and also asbestos fibers. So ripping out vinyl tile, for example, from a building could release this into the air. People need to think carefully about this.
Mentioned cancer, but what about asthma? What about autism. There was just a report the other day that indicates that autism rates are a lot higher than anyone imagined. Now they are up to 1 in 100.
Well, I find that to be striking, and I find it to be worrisome. I mean, there are several issues here. One is that the definition of autism has changed somewhat, and that could explain the rise in the count. But I think it's
not that much from thousands to 100.
I doubt it. I think that something is going on, and you know, my own hypothesis about it is that, you know, we're exposed to a variety of chemicals that assault the central nervous system. Metals such as lead, cadmium, mercury, mercury from fish, for example, and also organophosphate insecticides, carbamate insecticides. So a whole class of pesticides are neurotoxic, and there are even some components of plastic that target the central nervous system. So we are, from the time of conception to the time we pass away, we're exposed to a mixture of chemicals that are neurotoxic. Now, our law is not set up to control this mixture of neurotoxins or this mixture of carcinogens. It's more sector-specific, meaning that the pesticide industry is regulated or the pharmaceutical industry is regulated. But, you know, as you walk through daily life, you're accumulating exposures to a real mixture of chemicals that adversely affect health in different ways.
And even if it's only a little bit of this and a little bit of that, it can add up, I assume.
Well, you know, you need to think, too, about fetal exposure. And I'm most of my books, and this book included, concentrates on fetal, infant, and childhood exposures, and also pregnant women's exposures, because many of these compounds cross the placenta. So concentrations of these chemicals are measured and they're regulated, if they are regulated, based upon the idea of what is the unit per body weight. So if you think of, say, the average 70-kilogram male, and then think of a fetus that might be several months in age and may have a weight of maybe a pound or roughly a half a kilogram, but the same concentration in the mom is making its way through the placenta, and so that the exposure is expressed as how much of the chemical exists per unit of body weight. So the concentration is far higher among the youngest in society.
My guest is John Wargo. His book, Green Intelligence, Creating Environments That Protect Human Health, is published by Yale University Press. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, whenever we talk about regulating these kinds of things, we hear from politicians, we hear from people in industry that it's going to cost jobs. Is that the main reason for resistance to doing something about this?
Well, I think that the underlying engine here is the economy and concern about protecting markets and market shares. And this has had an effect in lobbying against stronger regulations. I think it explains very well why we don't have a national plastics policy, as an example. But I also think that we need to be careful about the way that we think about it. Is it fair to make a trade-off between children's exposure to recognized hazardous substances and economic profitability of a corporation making water bottles? And I think not.
Well, we have changed in terms of nuclear fallout, haven't we? There was a time when we were rather loose in our standards and exposed an awful lot of people to serious hazards. And now we rarely test the weapons, and if we do, it's underground testing.
Well, I think the way I expressed this in the book was that the atmospheric weapons testing ban, the nuclear weapons testing ban of 1963, is probably the greatest environmental health success story of the 20th century. And it taught not only that chemicals can easily go into global atmospheric circulation, but they could rain down to the ground and get into soils and into food chains. into corn and into cattle and thereby into our bodies.
We saw that with Chernobyl, where even though the explosion was in one specific place, it affected, it went all the way up to Scandinavia and elsewhere. And in this country, we would test the bombs in Nevada, but then the nuclear the mushroom cloud would travel all the way to the East Coast. Did the same sort of thing happen when we were testing nuclear weapons in the Pacific?
Absolutely. And the larger the weapon, the higher the in the stratosphere it would go, and the longer it would stay in circulation. And one interesting fact that the Atomic Energy Commission found out and kept as secret during the 1950s is that these particles would not make their way down to the Earth unless they intersected a rainstorm or a thunderstorm. So there was a patchiness to fallout, which explains why the New York milk supply was contaminated in the 50s and 1960s. And widespread concern over recognition that strontium-90 was building up in children's bone, predominantly from milk, led to President Kennedy's emphasis that this weapons testing ban be adopted.
We have two comments from listeners. One asks, does the use of recycled vegetable oils have any effect on the substances in diesel exhaust?
It does reduce particulate matter somewhat, but it is not a significant reduction. The studies I've looked at have demonstrated a 10 to 20% reduction in particulate matter. But it would be better than doing nothing, but biodiesel is not a clean fuel.
And then another listener asked, and I guess this is a question I would have asked, what's the practical alternative to using these chemicals? Can we avoid exposure to them?
Well, I think that there are many different examples of this, and I'd point to the organic food movement as one of the greatest successes of the last several decades. It's the fastest growing sector within the food industry right now.
Not according to a lot of my listeners. They all complain that we are elitists when we talk about this because we're promoting something that costs so much more money.
Well, many people believe that, but the evidence is pretty clear that over the past two decades, the prices have been coming down as more farmers plant more acres organically. And it's not uncommon to be able to buy organic apples for the same price as conventionally grown apples or grapes or pears. For some commodities such as milk, there still is this price differential. By the way, the organic industry has not received even close to a hundredth of a percent of the subsidies that the conventional food industry has received.
So is this really a matter of reallocation of funds and doing more research? Where do we get the money for the research?
Well, I think that we have grossly underestimated the scale of this problem and the intensity of monitoring and surveillance that is required to know where these chemicals are in daily life. I mean, one example that I wanted to bring up has to do with cleaning products. And many people use cleaning products in their home or in their lives that they do not comprehend. And I believe that, for example, the concept of dry cleaning is an oxymoron, and people should pay attention to this, that there are new methods of cleaning clothing, new cleaners in the marketplace, some here in New York are small startups that use CO2. And you may say, oh, no, CO2. But this is endorsed by the Environmental Protection Agency because the CO2 is captured after the cleaning process. So a very, very minor amount, less than several percent of it is released. And the alternative is a solvent, perchloroethylene, PERC as it's known, that is well recognized to contaminate groundwater. And it's also a substance that can be measured in people's blood and in their breath when they put on their freshly dry, clean clothes.
How does this does the United States compare to other countries in this regard? Are we less concerned?
Well, we used to have the most advanced body of environmental law up to about 1990. Now the European Union is far more advanced than we are, and some nations within the Union are more advanced. Denmark, for example. their law is founded on the idea of precaution, the idea of transparency and public participation. So their whole approach is to make the public more literate, require that companies label their products for their ingredients, their country of origin, and the United States has resisted that approach.
John Wargo is professor of environmental policy, risk analysis, and political science at the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies and the Department of Political Science at Yale University. His latest book, Green Intelligence, Creating Environments That Protect Human Health. It's published by Yale University Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
No, thank you. I really appreciate your interest.